Hey there, welcome to the Cause and Effect podcast, where we talk about the human stories and lives of entrepreneurs and change makers here in Oregon. This is your host, Ryan Buchanan, and I'm here with my longtime friend, Duncan Campbell, who is founder of Campbell Global, but is most known as founder of Friends of the Children, which is the number one most admired nonprofit in Oregon for the fifth year in a row, as well as 20 chapters around the country. And is there more?
We just had our entered into our 21st city.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And he also recently published a book called The Art of Being There. So we'll get into a whole bunch more. So, Dunk, you and I met 18 years ago when my wife was pregnant with our oldest daughter, Grace. And we met through my lifelong friend, Eric Gabrielson, who I went to college with back at University of Virginia. We moved out here together. And his mentor was Doug Stamm, who ran your national organization. And so I got involved, and I really didn't know what I was getting myself into because I've been on the board of Friends in Portland for 13 years. And I just, what I'm drawn to and kind of amazed by is this commitment to long term. Like, board members have been on the board for 15 years, employees have been here 20, 25 years. And how did you create that when, you know, in your own upbringing, your parents didn't necessarily foster that sense of long-term, you know, commitment?
Well, even though it originated in my childhood, because I really never did have a relationship with my parents, relationship is at the core of everything, even in my childhood, let alone in business. Whatever success I built in business had to do with performance, but to sustain relationships with people is at the core of my success in business. And then literally, I carry that around with me through my adult life, and later on, the essence of Friends of the Children is a relationship the friend has with the children we serve, and it's just been core.
So how... Like, I think so much of childhood is formative, and not, you basically had an example of maybe what not to do with, you know, your folks. I think it was your dad who was an alcoholic, or both were, or
yeah, both my parents were alcoholics, lived in bars and taverns. We were a welfare family. My dad was in prison twice, and then literally later on in my life, I'm 12 years old, I make a conscious choice that I'm not going to be like my parents, and then number two, I don't want another child to have that childhood, which was later the emotional premise of Friends.
So how do you, for me, I've had two loving parents who've been there at every step of the way for me, and they've role modeled what to do. And yet you, and I know this is a big part of your story, it's just really hard for me to wrap my head around where you didn't have that from your parents, and you really didn't have a mentor as a kid either. And yet you, I get that that's a huge motivation to start this, you know, mentoring program where you really reach out to the most vulnerable kids, often in foster care, other things like that, that no one else really hits. It's kind of like running into a burning building. Like, no one else wants to go into something that hard mm-hmm. and risky. And I just wonder how you knew how to do this without someone role modeling it for you.
Well, actually, there was two aspects of that. First off, because of my family circumstances, I considered myself white trash. But on the other hand, you know, nobody came over to my house. I mean, it smelled like booze, smoke. But I spent a lot of time at my friend's house. And they fortunately had either a wonderful father and or mother. And they became the role models. In fact, first time I ever went fishing was with the father of my best friend. And actually, hanging out over there became a role model for Friends of the Children, because even today we have houses in the community where the friends can take the children into a wholesome, clean house, show them how to cook, serve a meal, do crafts, do homework, etc. But it's based on the idea of when I'd go to my friend's house and be in a good place. And that was a catalyst for me to learn a different behavior than what my parents showed me.
Okay, it's starting to make more sense to me. And then one more question before we get into your story is, you know, so I mentioned foster care. So it was like 3 years ago, my wife and I went through this training on how to be foster parents. And it was like I had this huge awakening learning on just what it means to for, you know, what trauma really is and attachment. And there's some stat of like a baby or an infant, there's 250 moments every day where they're looking for assurance and, you know, some sort of like connection to someone who's providing for, you know, food or milk or whatever. And are there's, you know, because you didn't have, you know, some of those things as a kid, are there, I know one thing, and I'm looking at your desk right now of how it manifests for you, is that you take notes on like little stickies and you have storage facilities full of little sticky notes. Like how does that show up in your life now as a 75 or 76 year old guy?
You know, most of this, the stickers and post-it notes have to do with people and either follow up to get things done. It's just a eclectic way of keeping track where other people do it in different ways. But it goes all the way back to relationships. I mean, you know, I still have breakfast every week with two friends for 40 years. I mean, that's so important to me. You know, even with my faith, I've been in a Christ-centered men's group. It's almost more important to me than church I go to on Sunday, because once again, it's rooted in relationships and love, which we'll talk about a little bit later.
Yeah, I know love is at the center of all of this. And I think that's probably the easiest one word answer of a lot of my questions, which like you really embody that. And that is at the heart of relationships, is you kind of always exude that. So, you know, I know you've touched on you go deep into your childhood story in the book, and then you also did a TEDx talk, which, by the way, I would be so scared to like speak in front of 3,000 people with all the lights. Did that get your heart aflutter at all, or were you fine?
You know, it's interesting. Unlike a lot of people, they just can't wait to get on stage. I dread it for 2 to 3 weeks beforehand. But once I start, I'm fine, because I do it naturally. It's not like giving a speech. But as a matter of fact, that TED Talk is the last speech. But I've done, you know, convention centers, coliseums in the past, speaking about friends and or entrepreneurship, but mainly friends. But once again, the TED Talk is my final speech ever. I'll still do interviews and panels, but that's it.
Yeah, so if you, I'm like you, if I know the subject material, like my own story or entrepreneur story, then I can flow with it. Yeah, so, but it's still a lot to, you know, get on that stage, and it's so inspiring, and you did an incredible job, so I was really proud of you.
Thank you.
Okay, So I know, you know, you and I have played hoops together in your pool with my two daughters. But so you were like, when you were 6 and 8, what kinds of activities were you into? Were you into all kinds of different sports?
Yeah, basically, because I was left alone most of my childhood, I'd get up in the morning in the summers and we'd play ball all day. I mean, I played baseball, football, basketball, and actually a couple of coaches became kind of mentors to me, which is part of my nurturing, because I wasn't getting any at home. For example, when I played football in high school and even Little League Baseball, my parents never came to a game ever. And it just kind of shows you the nature of my family situation.
Yeah. So I definitely resonate with just constantly being busy, and we lived a little bit more in the woods, so there was a lot of like forts and stuff like that. Yours was more urban. You grew up in northeast Portland, and ultimately went to Jeff. Like, where'd you go to elementary, and what's your path?
Well, actually, the neighborhood I grew up in actually had some vacant lots, and we used to climb trees all the time.
Oh, okay.
But that's the closest. Right. Later on, I mean, my wife and I are backpackers and done part of the Pacific Crest Trail. But no, literally, we get up in the morning and we'd play ball all day. And then we'd go over to a friend's house. And once again, I would rarely come home.
But so just to get, for the listener's sake, to get a sense of geography, right now we're in Friends of the Children office in Northeast Portland, really close to Legacy Emmanuel Hospital. You grew up maybe a mile from here. And what were the names of the schools that you went to?
Yeah, grade school I went to, it's now known as Martin Luther King School. It was called Highland back then, and then went to Jefferson High School. And once again, this was a high crime, high poverty community. You know, now it's starting to get gentrified. But even here in the building we're in, you know, we had somebody shoot somebody across the street, run through the building in the back door, out the front. But you would not walk or come through this neighborhood when I was a child all the way through. But we did because we were young and stupid.
Yeah. Actually, we'll get to your Jeff story, but one other small world story is my wife's mom was in the same grade as you, or maybe a year older or younger.
Same age.
Wendy
grade.
Morgan.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So we're gonna be spending Christmas with her at our house, and so I'll say hi.
Yeah, do that, because she was a spirit. And she was like me in a lot of ways, because she had a diverse group of friends. And I think, you know, like I'd run with the Socias or I'd run with the Hoods. I kind of was all over the spectrum, because I did some rascal things. I mean, it's going to be hard to believe, but I actually got suspended from high school for fighting. And most people would think I'm much nicer than that.
Well, I do think it's super helpful as an entrepreneur to be a rebel, and you've got a loving, rebellious spirit to you. So, yeah.
Thank you. That's one of the nicest things anybody's ever said. You know, it's interesting. I was fortunate enough to win an Entrepreneur of the Year award one time, and they were going to do a video for the presentation. And the guy said, "Well, what's the most important word in business?" And I pause, and I say, "Love." I mean, I'd never said that ever in my life consciously. It was Freudian. But it's, you know, it's all that conversation we had about relationship. Because in business, you know, you have to perform. I was in the investment business. Performance is key. But to have a sustained, meaningful relationship with clients, it's based on trust and confidence and the relationship. But I couldn't believe I used the word love. But it's at the core of all the work we do with friends. Because even the children we serve, most of them don't think anybody cares for them, let alone loves them.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I think part of what I want a lot of listeners in this podcast is, you know, we have a lot of purpose-driven entrepreneurs that that I interview with, but that are also part of this community. And that's where I get back to role modeling. It's like you have role modeled this way to have success and significance. And so I think there's a lot that we can take away in this story. So I just, we'll get there to the whole legacy piece that I think is fascinating what you're doing. But okay, so one of the questions that I almost always ask, and I think for this, like the age in which I ask it is really important. So I usually say, when you're an 8-year-old boy and an adult asks you, what do you want to be when you grow up? What was your answer? And then from what you just said 5 minutes ago about your kind of awakening at 12 years old, did you have a different answer?
Clearly, in my early childhood, all the way through, I'd say the eighth grade, two things were going on. I mean, all I thought about was sports. I wanted to either be a major league pitcher or a quarterback in NFL. I never had any thoughts because I didn't know any professionals or any options. Now, later on, because I wanted to be somebody because I thought I was nobody, you know, I was either going to be a lawyer, a doctor, or rich. But it was so naive because I never met a doctor, let alone a lawyer. But those, that was the childhood. And yet later on, I actually became some of those things.
you kind of doubled up on some of these things as far as what you majored in and stuff. But okay, so when you were at Jefferson High School, you had this diverse group of friends. You were an athlete. You were rebellious and got into a little bit of trouble. But did you, I guess, maybe describe what other kinds of stuff your friends were in? Did you like hang out with the brainiac kind of nerd folks or anything? Or like, were you more just athlete and troublemakers? Was that your kind of crew?
You know, at the core, when I look back, given your question, you know, I really hung out with friends, but they were diverse. I was unique in the sense that I would reach back and touch people and
like,
and
ethnically diverse, or like describe diverse for me.
Ethnically diverse. I went to a school that was primarily African American, and to me, I couldn't even imagine discriminating against anything. And so I had that experience. But then I would, you know, hang out with bright people. Some of my friends barely made it through high school, but just as diverse. But they all had the kind of, they were spirited, good natured people would be it. And but I hung out with a few people who did a lot of major shoplifting also.
So let's talk about that. Like, you described some really kind of dramatic, traumatic things, like fires in your house and things like that. Mm-hmm. What are one or two life moments that stand out in your mind from either childhood or up through graduating from high school?
Well, there's probably a couple. The main one in my childhood, I'm like 4 years old. I wake up in the middle of the night, scared. I go in to my parents' bedroom. They're not in there. I wander the house. Nobody's home. I put my pants on inside out. I head down the street. I make it about four blocks, and there's a bakery worker standing out there having a cigarette. It's about midnight. And he said, "Where are you going, kid?" And I said, "I'm looking for my parents." And obviously, so he calls the cops, who actually knew our family because they'd been to the home a few times with my parents fighting, took me to the bar. We got my parents, who were dead drunk, and then we went home. So that's a vivid memory, you know, they'll never forget.
Yeah, that wasn't like the only time. I mean, there were other moments throughout your childhood that, you know, it's rare. I met probably 1,000 entrepreneurs, and I've never known anyone with quite your story of overcoming adversity again and again and again.
Yeah. So. Well, even I'm 8 years old and I'm going to be sworn in as a Cub Scout, but you had to have a parent there, and I'm waiting, and the scoutmaster says they can't swear me in because my parents aren't there. And then they go ahead, and you can imagine the embarrassment and shame, but I get up and start to run out, and here, banging in the back doors, my dad dead drunk, saying, I'm here. Now I'm bawling like a baby, and I just run crying all the way home. And so that's another moment. But then a tipping point for me, because I had a fifth grade teacher who saw some good in me. I had a seventh grade basketball coach, a high school football coach. But the tipping point for me was at the end of my senior year, you had to see the counselor. Everybody did. And he said to me, he said, "Duncan, you can be more than what most people think you are." And that was actually the motivation and catalyst from that day forward.
The power of mentors, mm-hmm. You know, even though it sounds like that might have just been a, you know, not necessarily a one-time moment, but you can hear something one day from a particular person that 10 other people might tell you, and it doesn't hit you like that.
Exactly. And what it did, it instilled in me hope, which is exactly one of the essential elements of friends. Most of these children don't have a sense of hope. And through the relationship over the 12 years we're with them, the friends instills in them a sense of hope and spirit.
Yeah. So I did a little bit of research before this interview, even though I've known you for a long time, and it was pretty fun. I came across this one piece that said that in order to attempt to pay for college, you put in an ad in the Oregonian that said, "Wanted, private loan for young man putting himself through college." which is just so entrepreneurial and chutzpah there and all of that. I love that. So did it work? What happened from there?
Nobody answered my ad, but it's interesting because that's kind of who I was. I had a lot of gumption. I mean, I was selling things door to door, and I was a little pistol that way. But I was so naive. I mean, one thing growing up in the hood, you might learn some street smarts, but so naive in the world. But, you know, I thought somebody would, you know, respond. I mean, and nobody did.
So, I mean, was tuition in, like, you went to U of O, right?
Well, I went to three different colleges. Okay. The first 2 years I went to Portland State because it was my only option. I lived at home. And then later on, I went to Oregon State for a year, went to Oregon for a year, then went to law school at the University of Oregon. Three times. I quit. I hated law school, but I because one of the entrepreneur elements is Campbells don't quit.
So, okay, so Eric is my age, and his daughters are a little younger than mine, but there's a lot of our friends are in the same boat where our kids are about ready to go to college, and it's like I am thinking about saving close to like $300,000 for tuition, room, board, all that. It's crazy. So I want to know, like, what was tuition back in your day?
$110 a term, $330 a year. And even at that time, speaking of the entrepreneur part, I had three jobs. I washed dishes at night, I washed cars during the day, and on the weekend, I pumped gas and washed boats out at the yacht club.
Wow. So you didn't have a lot of free time.
No, but I had fun. But yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, that's true a lot of my life. I work hard, but I also play hard.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so you go to U of O to become a public accountant, and then you also get your JD MBA. So you had both the accountant side and the law side.
Well, I became graduated from law school, became a lawyer. And I only had 1 year of accounting. I never intended to be an accountant, but when I went to work at Arthur Anderson, you had to be a CPA. And so I took the exam, and I'd only had a year of accounting. I went to a 1 week refresher course and passed it. So,
do you have a photographic memory? Like how do you do that?
I do not have a photographic memory. But on a lighter note, I do have a pretty good memory, and people don't want to tell me things because I always remember later on and hold them accountable in business. So.
Yeah, that's dangerous. Okay, so I think your entrepreneur story is really fascinating as far as you're in your late 30s. I think that's right. And you saw that some of your investors or some of your clients were, they could make some money on timberlands, like on real estate, but basically improving timberlands. So tell us a little bit about how the Campbell Group, you know, that origin story.
Well, at that time, I was in my late 30s, and I was either going to be a director of a social service agency, start a franchise pizza chain, or start a timber investment firm. And I had a lot of forest products companies as clients. And then just as to encourage entrepreneurs, I went to one of the most respected business people I knew and a good friend, said, "What do you think of my idea?" And he said, "Well, first off, nobody's going to give you any money to invest in timber. And if they did, you're not going to be able to buy any because every forest products company was buying every acre they could." Mm-hmm. Fortunately, he was wrong, but because once again, Campbells don't quit.
So how did you find land that and buy it before the, you know, the Georgia Pacifics and the big dogs got a hold of some great opportunity? Did you find the stuff that was on the fringe? Like, how did it work?
Well, the essence of it was that there was actually an undergoing change. A lot of the forest products companies were diversifying and actually did dispose of significant. When I started, I mean, my first transaction was a couple of million dollars. And then, you know, we did did 10 million, 20 million, 25, 100 million plus. But
raising
they
the
were
money
selling.
For the first transaction was the hardest of all, right?
Oh, by far. Yeah. I mean, all I did was
cold call.
Yeah. I got a big book of all the investment firms around the country, and I'd call and say, I'm going to be in San Francisco in 3 weeks. Would you be interested in talking about timber? No. My whole life is built. I'm looking for the few yeses. And I did the same thing in Los Angeles, New York, London. And I just kept going.
And who said yes first?
The first investor was actually the heir of a very wealthy family out of Los Angeles. And then later on, we did a first investment by China in the United States. And then we partnered with another firm to do a larger investment with the major pension funds. So, for example, Harvard was our largest endowment client, and CalPERS, which is the largest pension fund in the country, was our largest pension fund.
But I want to go back to that first yes, because what I've done, you know, almost as part of this really scrappy entrepreneur peer group called Starvups, we started it, and we did this exercise where we found a energy bar local company, and everybody you had to sell as much of that product in a day. We just did an experiment between entrepreneurs across 10 different companies, and basically the person with the most established network of who they knew, they're like, I'll buy $1,000 worth of these energy bars. Yeah. And I'll figure out who to give them to or what have you. But you didn't really, you didn't have a network of who you knew. You were just cold calling, which is probably the worst strategy ever, because people, it's all about trust.
Right.
So how did you get that first person to be interested? And then did you pull all of your loving relationship connection stuff on them to say, okay, I'm trustworthy enough for that person to put in, $500,000 or whatever he or she put in?
Yeah. Kind of the one of the critical elements of being an entrepreneur is you can't quit. I mean, most people run into trouble or challenges or a lot of no's, get frustrated or quit. But for example, when I worked my way from Portland to San Francisco, Los Angeles to New York to Chicago, I made a call on an investment firm in Los Angeles. And then a month and a half, 2 months later, said a client just walked in the door and they want to invest in timber. Do you still have that opportunity? And you didn't know. There was I had no existing relationships, except later on, after about 4 or 5 years, somebody I knew in Portland who knew somebody in New York who knew somebody in Los Angeles introduced us to China and the China Investment Trust Corps was looking to acquire some timber in order to learn how to do logging, marketing, etc. And everybody was ignoring them, so they retained us, and then we made the first investment by China in the United States. But that's so connections do make, mainly on larger clients, but in the early days, I was just looking for anybody who would give it serious consideration.
Yeah. I mean, I have built my business on creating connections and a network, but I also had a lot of privilege in, having college paid for and having a safety net if I were to fail. I mean, you didn't have any of that. You didn't have, you paid your way through college and you didn't have a safety net and you didn't have a network and you just kind of started creating it in your late 30s, where most people are like, oh, I'm going to just coast in my public accountant job.
Right. But I was unique once again in a different sense, and that was I always had an option. I mean, I'm always, because when people quit, I got one or two or three options, and you got to be thinking ahead. So, for example, I ran out of money 7 times. I didn't make any money until 5 years later, but I had something. I probably got one of the last character loans from a bank. First, they lent me 25,000, then 50, 100, 250. I got up to $1 million before they realized.
Because you're a good guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And they thought, then they came to me and said, we realized we were your venture capital firm, and they wanted to raise it a couple of points. I said, yes, because that was still half of what venture capital costs.
For sure.
But that doesn't exist. You know, now it's all credit and collateral, and I had no credit.
Well, it worked. It worked. So I'm sure they are happy with how it turned out. But yeah, that's amazing. Okay, so did you start Friends of the Children while you were still running Campbell Group, or Campbell? It became called it Campbell Global. Or did you exit? Because I think you exited after 7 years of running it, or. Mm-hmm. How did that timing work out?
I sold it after about 7 years, and which for the first time in my life provided capital. I never really had any net worth. I mean, I had a good middle class, upper middle class income, and but when I sold the firm, that gave me funds, and I used some of those funds to start Friends of the Children. So I was still working, and then after I sold it, you know, I had to have a 3-year employment contract, but I tapered down, like where one day you work and then one day you quit. That's I went 80, 60, 40, 20 and never looked back. And then basically started Friends in my old neighborhood and built it from there.
So, and Friends is 26 years old, right?
Right. Yeah.
So you started it when you were 50, right around there?
Yeah, late 40s, right.
Late 40s. And one of the cool things in your book is that, you know, I think about all of the specifics of how you started Friends of the Children, because now that it's so large, it's like, well, of course it's successful. But really in those early days, it could have not been. And one of the things that's fascinating is how important you placed energy around outcomes and data and things like that. And you partnered with like a researcher or a scientist and that gave you basically the data to say that one mentor can really make a difference if he or she is paired with eight kids. Mm-hmm. So they can spend 4 hours a week with them. Yeah. Talk to me about all the things you learned in those first years starting Friends of the Children.
Well, beyond that emotional commitment I made when I'm 12 years old to not have another child have the childhood I had. Later on, when I was quitting law school, I went and worked at the juvenile court full time for two more years part time while I was in law school. Loved it. Couldn't believe I got paid to do it. But little or nothing changes in the juvenile court system, and that's when
it wasn't preventative. It was like we're dealing with it after kids are a problem.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
And they'd brag about their brothers or sisters were in there, and their father had been in there. Nobody wants to say it, but a lot of them are intergenerational. And if we have time, I'll tell you a great story on that. But then later on, that's when I came up with the idea, Friends, that we had to start early with a long-term caring relationship, etc. But then when I sold my firm and was going to start it, I hired a PhD child psychologist who did extensive research and showed the early theory was that if you started early with a long-term caring relationship with a mentor that shared values with the child over that 12 and a half year period of time, you could change the path of their life. So it was both, it was emotional, empirical, and then based on research. And because for me, I was all about outcomes. I mean, my business model carried over. And we've had a third-party evaluation every year from inception, 26 years, almost no nonprofit does that. They'll tell you wonderful, touching, poignant stories, and we have them. But we've got data of every year, the real outcomes, which are incredible, beyond imagination.
Yeah, so just so folks know, it's starting in kindergarten and 12 and a half years commitment, no matter what happens. Again, these are not, you don't find those kindergartners at schools where you ask the teachers, like, hey, give us your best kids. Like, give us the kids that are, you know, behave the best and, you know, all that stuff. It's more like the ones who are either completely you know, not present at school because they've just got all kinds of things at home, or they're just, you know, have behavioral issues or, you know, what have you. And so, yeah, what were some of those early things that you or some early outcomes that you saw?
Yeah, well, just before the outcomes, so say there's 100 kindergarten children in a school in the middle of Harlem. It's the opposite of the playground choosing of kids. Right, yeah. We want the number one pick is the most vulnerable child in the school, and our number two pick, we pick the 8 most at risk, most vulnerable children, because we want to deal with causes. And most of them, as you'll see, like for example, even on the outcomes, 83% of our children graduate from high school when almost all of their parents did not finish high school. 93% of our kids avoid the juvenile justice system, and 50% of their parents were incarcerated. And 98% avoid early parenting when over 80% had a teen mother. And that's the whole essence of Friends, to break that whole intergenerational cycle. And then we address all the barriers, because the children are still at home in challenging circumstances, and yet the friend through this relationship changes the whole path of their life.
Yeah, it's really cool. I think one maybe misperception that a lot of folks have is that the friend is somehow trying to replace the parents, and it's really the opposite. It's partnering with the whole family and lifting the whole family up.
Right. There's very few two-parent families. A lot of single teen mothers, and then grandma or grandpa. 40 to 70% of our children, depending on the city, are foster care children. And that's where we want to be, and basically change the whole path of their life. And the commitment by the friends is unconditional. There's nothing we will do during that 12 and a half year period. We'll never leave that child.
And so what happened 7 years ago in your life where you said, okay, it's time to scale this model? Like, why didn't you start earlier? Why do it? Like, why not just focus on the Portland and the 3 other cities that you were in? You're on this like rocket ship for scaling something that you feel like is a life calling and is your legacy, is this entity called Friends of the Children, and maybe even something bigger than that. But how do you go from 4 or 5 cities and chapters to 21 in just 5 or 7 years? Like, what happened to trigger that?
Well, once again, we wanted to make sure it worked. So once again, we're 26 years old, but after the 4th or 5th year, we could tell we were changing these children's lives. And then we, as I mentioned, we had data every year on every child, detailed plans. So we were seeing outcomes. So, for example, if it hadn't worked, I would say it was a great idea, but unfortunately it wasn't rooted in reality. But the good news is we were rooted in reality. And then as people heard about it, it's all by word of mouth. Somebody told somebody who told somebody, because we only go to other cities, we're invited. So as people heard, somebody would get an article. We had an article in People magazine. We had another one then in Fortune. And then we had another one in Forbes. And then people hear, and then it can be anywhere from a philanthropist to a venture capitalist brought us to Boston. We competed. He wanted to bring real programs that worked and get rid of programs that didn't. And lawyers and judges brought us to New York City, for example. And it's been a diverse group throughout the country. But they were responding to the fact that we really made the change and we had the data to back it up.
But what about you personally? And I'm going to give you some context. So I co-founded Emerging Leaders 4 years ago. And so I'm watching your trajectory, you know, 22 years ahead of me. And there's got to be some element of like how you balance it all. For example, you know, you spend 4 months of the year in Sisters and you're in paradise on earth and you want to hike and all this stuff. Yet when you start scaling like this, Duncan, I need you in DC. Duncan, I need you in Chicago. Duncan, I need you here because we're meet like this billionaire investor, you know, needs to meet you personally. How do you balance living, you know, this life of freedom and being in the outdoors and loving every bit, and then also so rewarding and fulfilling, but the travel piece, like, how do you do that whole balance thing?
Yeah. Well, the core answer to that is I was very conscious and intentional over time to add quality people. So the team in Portland, which was the original chapter, is outstanding. And then we built incrementally a national team. And it's that team that is really making it successful. I was a catalyst. And then I did, and all those things you just mentioned, I do. But like, for example, and I would go and do them because I still was spirited and alive. But like, I retired this year from speeches. I did the TED Talk, for example, and I'll do an interview or something like this. But I'm no longer doing that. I went and spent 3 days in back east. We raised $400,000, but I had 2 breakfasts, 2 lunches, 2 dinners. I'm retiring because now I'm 75, and then went to Los Angeles, gave a speech to a convention, came back, went to Los Angeles to Denver, did another one, and then did a workshop in Colorado Springs. But I'm retired because, once again, we build a team.
Are you really retiring, or are you just saying that? And I'll, then you'll get pulled out of retirement.
No, I'm really saying it, and you can hold me accountable, and anybody
okay.
listening.
I remember these things, yeah. And now it's going to yeah, be
but
on
I will
the web.
Go still to a major foundation or a special meeting.
Okay. All right. I'm taking mental notes here.
Thank
taking
you.
Mental notes.
I appreciate it.
Okay, so if you actually... My question, I only have a couple questions left, but I'm going to two-parter. The second part is, who inspires you in this moment, like really inspires you? But the first part is, I'm fascinated to know, back to the origin story of how you started Friends of the Children, kind of who some other folks were in those early years that were really instrumental, because I think it always takes more than one person to really get something off the ground. So who was early on, and then now today, who really inspires you?
You know, it's interesting because back then, as I mentioned, I had a fifth grade teacher that kind of saw who I could be. I had a seventh grade basketball coach, and then a football coach who encouraged me. And then that poignant comment that I could be more than what most people thought I could be by the counselor. But I didn't really have anybody else other than that. And once again, I grew up very naive, even though, as I mentioned, I was street smart. And I'd always died to have a partner. I mean, being an but if you thought my childhood was bad, being an entrepreneur, as you know, is very challenging, and you can be alone. But, you know, once again, it's really bringing quality people alongside of me. So I had some people who came alongside of me early because, you know, we didn't know we were going to make it.
What were their names?
Risk. Pardon?
What were some of those names of folks early on?
My operations guy, for example, Jerry Brody, who has been a long-term friend. John Gilliland, who is the current CEO of it. Worked with my wife, was a young accountant, and came and joined us and now leads the firm. But I had a lot of people come
that
alongside
was Campbell Group. Is
that's
that
Campbell Global.
What about Friends of the Children?
In Friends, once again, I created it primarily alone, except Mike Forsley was who worked at the juvenile court with me. And there you manage the kids because you could lock them up or power. We got 90% of the kids to do whatever we wanted based on relationship again. And Mike was the first executive director of it for years. His wife came to work as a program manager and was very helpful. And now with Terry Sorensen and her team at National,
she's
it's outstanding.
Talking in the background right now.
Yeah.
Yep. No, I hear you. Okay. And so today, as you look at the whole world, one person alive today who inspires you?
To be honest, actually, my faith is what really drives me. And as I mentioned earlier, I've had people in business who I respected and encouraged me, but I really don't have a particular person. I mean, beyond this conversation, I mean, I'm a person of faith. I have a relationship with Christ. And if I have anything, it's that. But I'm in a small group of friends, and they encourage and support me. You know, we share how we're doing, what's working, what isn't, how we encourage and support. And I've been doing that for 40 years, and that's a meaningful part. But it's really friends in general, not any one particular person.
I just think, if you think about it, and I'm a huge believer in this and live into it, but the power of small groups.
Mm-hmm.
So the Friends of the Children model is a one-to-one relationship, but it's really small groups because that mentor has 8 kids and there's bonds that form as a small group. And that, so you really live into your legacy around receiving the benefit of mentorship for 40 years with friends and how you interact with with all of your key people, like all your employees. I guess even now you have kind of more of a chairman or founder pastor. You're not even an employee of Friends of the Children.
Right.
So it's really just like you said, loving friendships with every aspect of your life, which is a really cool thing to see it role modeled instead of just paid lip service, you know?
Exactly. And then we don't use this word, but the modern society does culture. And at Campbell Global, people love to come to work there. But we created that culture. I mean, they had to be technically experts, knowledgeable, capable. And yet we didn't hire curmudgeons, for example, but there was a wonderful spirit. And you walk the halls here. I mean, one of the reasons I even come here, it's a joy to be around the people because here they're giving
positive energy, like filling you back up.
Absolutely. Yeah. Which is, I think, just as important in business as it is in doing this work for the children. Yeah.
So my last question, and this is always one I usually have to provide context to, but I find it really, just really, really interesting of, is there a life moment that you look back on where it's not a surprise that you ended up in this success and significant place in your life by either a moment that was hard that you like had the grit to overcome and the Campbell's never quit, or that gave you a lot of independence and freedom and confidence to try something big that you might fail 7 times and, you know, get the money on the 8th time or whatever it is. Is there a life moment that you, and maybe you already gave it in, but maybe there's something else that you haven't shared that.
No, I think the tipping point at that point occurred to me twice in my life. And the first would be actually having an idea is one thing, and then having people challenge it that it might not work, and then making a success of it, both at Campbell Global, then again at Friends of the Children. And so I'm a big believer in brainstorming, making things happen. So we're in a board meeting of the National Friends the other day, and when we're talking about growth, and somebody was real, we got to be really careful and everything, you know, having this debate. And then they say, unlike Duncan, who if there's one drop of water in the glass, it's full. And everybody, of course, thought that was quite funny. But the point is, I'm an optimist, but I do the things that I think are possible. I'm very fortunate. But I'm rooted in reality. My whole life is, I know what's real. I don't deny anything about reality, whether it's my childhood or the risks in business. And then I take a path forward. And I would say that's been, really the key to my success. Because even when I ran out of money, I had options. You know, I'm thinking, I've got plans, but I make things. So
you're scrappy. You're scrappy.
That's an understatement. But I said, I'm the most cynical optimist you ever met, because I mean, you're not in denial of a childhood like mine and then the difficulty, but then I chose a path and then I made it real.
Well, that is an awesome note to end on. So thank you so much for being on the show. And it's just been great to spend the last 50 minutes with you.
I enjoyed it. Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it. Take care.
Cheers.